96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, January 15th. Next Wednesday, City of Sarasota planners will be discussing a proposal to build a 44-townhome complex on Aspinwall Street and Lime Avenue just east of downtown. The developers seeking the city's go-ahead to build on smaller lot sizes and higher density than current rules allow. All of the homes would be market rate. For more information, go to the city's commission meetings page and look for the December 21st Development Review Committee meeting. Consider sunbathing and swimming at a different beach as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Contractors will begin renourishment of Lido Beach this Tuesday. To be sure, the beach will stay open for the duration of the $12 million project, which is expected to be completed by April. But sections of the beach may be temporarily inaccessible, beginning at the north end and moving south. Under a 50-year agreement with the city, the Army Corps of Engineers commits to refilling Lido Beach every 5 years. The Lido shoreline degraded significantly during the 2024 hurricane season. In 2020, Manatee County voters approved a referendum to fund acquisition of natural lands. Now those funds are running low. On January 6th, Manatee County Commissioners voted to request assistance from the nonprofit organization Trust for Public Land to craft future conservation efforts. Once the organization completes a feasibility study, the county may approve a referendum to continue millage collection to go on the 2026 ballot. Much of Florida is under a freeze watch today as a strong cold front moves across the state. Some areas up north are looking at lows in the 20s and even snow. Sarasota is likely to see temperatures bottom out in the mid-30s, along with some scattered showers. A protest erupted in St. Petersburg this week outside the Hilton Carillon, where U.S. Customs and Border Patrol is holding a recruitment event. Waving signs and honking horns, the demonstrators called for justice for Renee Good, the woman fatally shot by an immigration enforcement agent in Minneapolis last week. Two people were arrested at the protest, both for charges including trespassing. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, January 15th. Thank you to Bryce Claypool for compiling them.
The following program has been pre-recorded. Presentation. Talk of the Town, a WSLR News Roundtable, airs Saturdays from 11 to noon on WSLR. Talk of the Town is a panel discussion radio program featuring politicians, activists, academics, policy analysts, and investigative journalists. They will join me, Carrie Seidman, for a deep dive into the local issues of the day. It's an hour of analysis and debate with a dash of humor and snark. Learn more about Talk of the Town at WSLR.org and tune in Saturdays at 11 a.m.
WSLR, 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. And I apologize because the sound on my end is, it's okay. All right, programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2024-25 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery. Okay, my guest today is Bruce Baker. Bruce is a professor at the University of Miami who's done incredible research on Florida's education system. Bruce, you also graduated from Columbia Teachers College. My niece just graduated from there, so yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. It's a great place to go to school. So let's just cut to the chase, Bruce. You've put out some impressive research on what's happening with Florida's public education system and what needs to change to ensure a high-quality education for all children in Florida. I want to start with what you call Florida's race to the bottom. I moved here in 1999, two sons who entered Florida public schools, and I recall voting on a constitutional amendment in 2002, which was going to guarantee a high-quality education for all Florida children. And I think at that time, too, there were particular standards about student-teacher ratios. So I'm not hearing you, Bruce. Are you? Can you hear me okay? We're on Zoom.
I can hear you fine. Can I be heard by others on that? Okay.
Okay. So anyway, tell me about the race to the bottom. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting because like you said, the voters in the state of Florida were given the chance in 1998 and in 2002 to ratify a constitutional amendment that required the state to provide a high quality system of efficient, safe, free public schools for all Florida school children. And really it's almost that like soon after that, it starts to slide. Within the next few years, there was a sharp shift in more of the funding coming from like local public school districts, counties. So local funding became dominant over state funding, even though it's primarily a state obligation. It's in the Constitution, voted on by Floridians not so long ago. And then over the last like 10 to 15 years, the state has systematically, year after year, reduced the percent of its economic capacity that it spends on public education to the point where, you know, even if the state was spending the same percent of, you know, total income or gross state, like GDP state, the same percent that the state was spending in like 2005 to 2007, we'd have over 28% more money in the system. And Florida has been chasing states like Arizona to the bottom of all states in the percent of our economic capacity that we do spend on public schools. And at the same time, we've dispersed money for education across now three systems. And one of the things I point out in a lot of my research is that it's actually a lot more expensive. There are duplicative costs, additional expenses, inefficiencies that are added when you try to run two systems in one space rather than one well-organized and efficiently managed system in one space.
Can I stop you there? Because, you know, there's been such verbiage, such messaging over the past 40, 50 years about the private sector and the free market. The public sector, like one of the benefits of public schools is when they're run efficiently and well, you're aggregating resources, you're using them more efficiently, right? So that all the money goes into a big pool, but you can fund special needs education, you can fund great sports programs because you're not having to duplicate the same services. You're not, you know, you're going to one printer for all your needs. I mean, it's a simple model, but people seem to think that there's no there's no cost to all the school choice, right? There's no cost to having tons of replication, when in fact there really is.
Well, there are a whole bunch of pieces there. I mean, first of all, one of the more geeky technical things that I show in my lengthy report on Florida schools and school funding is that Florida school districts, for what they have, which is that the funding in Florida is kind of lower middling among states. The effort in Florida is at the bottom, which we're not as poor as some states. So with the lowest effort, we can have kind of lower middling funding, and our outcomes are closer to middling. We actually outperform our level of funding.
That's what I was going to ask you next.
Florida schools, district schools are relatively efficient. Now, in the last few years, you know, even while other states have rebounded, Florida's eighth grade outcomes have continued to plummet. So I don't, you know to what extent we're losing some of that efficiency benefit, but we're also kind of continuing the backslide on funding. But yet there are a lot of reasons why an expanded choice system in a common space leads to inefficiencies. One is the duplicative administrative structures and all of that. Mm-hmm. Another is just the fluidity, planning for the unexpected fluidities in how we manage capital space and access to capital space. Of course, mm-hmm. Introduction to the Schools of Hope program complicates that, makes it a bigger mess.
Yes.
Imbalancing.
Totally bigger mess. Yeah. So to kind of recap, Bruce, what you're saying is that Florida school funding has gone down, right? Since it has. However, Florida public schools have actually, when you match their results to the level of funding that they're given, they're actually producing good results. They're actually producing good educational outcomes given the resources that they have.
Better than expected.
Better than expected. Okay.
That they get. Yep.
But those outcomes are still going down because the resources are going down, not because the teachers are failing somehow.
Right, and some of the other details in the report are the fact that if we control for changes to labor cost over time, statewide and even more sharply in like Miami-Dade, the current operating expenditures per pupil, the stuff that kind of pays the teachers, staff, administrators, keeps the lights on, and you know, your annual spending to run schools is lower in 2023, adjusted for labor cost, than it was in 1993, which... Actually, the CFO of Miami-Dade Schools found that rather shocking, but we feel that pain in the reducing numbers of support staff and other staffing roles in schools per kid. There are fewer adults per kid, even though we've tried to maintain staffing structures that let district administrators at least statistically claim they've hit the margins on those class size requirements adopted by voters in 2002. Mm-hmm. Right.
And weren't those, you know, I'm going to go off the script a little bit with regard to your report, but it was my recollection that the funding, you know, that Florida gave the green light to the lottery, and that the lottery was supposed to be this amazing funding resource for public schools. Is that, you know, did that turn out to be true?
Well, it doesn't appear to be. But the other thing is, again, the voters ratified constitutional language that set a high standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that set even specifics about how the schools would be run on class sizes and stuff like that. And
I remember.
On the legislature to meet that standard and to find the revenue to meet that standard, and the court, as has been done in many other states, to hold them to it.
Yeah.
The problem is our own state Supreme Court in 2019 looked at what the voters voted on and said, oh, that's just puffing, right? Which I...
it's incredible because what you write about and document in your report is that they're not upholding the Constitution. The state Supreme Court is not upholding the Constitution.
And they punted on the hard work and did so explicitly. Reading through the details of those decisions in Florida. Now, I've testified in state courts across numerous states in the country. I do contracted work to help state legislatures, and I'm working, with Vermont. I just worked with Oregon, Ohio, Colorado. I work with states around the country to help reform their school funding systems. I just recently moved to Florida. I decided to take this task on.
God bless you. Right? Moved here. You moved here for this.
And when
you came to the belly of the beast. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Constitutional requirements and how to make them. And the other thing that the court said was that, there's no way to develop a manageable standard. And the more sarcastic side of me said, more competent courts in many other states have done so.
Right.
So they just punted, as you said.
It's a good word.
Responsibility, saying that anything that has to do with taxation, financing, budgetary policy, that's all controlled by the legislature. The problem is it is possible for a legislature through its fiscal policy to deprive individuals of rights, as here and now. And it's up to the court to enforce those rights. That's just the court's job. And again, we're not talking about, at the founding of the state,
I want to talk a little bit about the history here, because you talk about in your paper that over time in the United States, all these states put in their state constitutions that they were going to educate children. And it was the southern states like Florida. It was after the Civil War. It was a requirement for them to be readmitted back into the Union that they actually educate all children, because the southern states had universally excluded black children from public schools.
I lean on the work of one of my friends and colleagues, a law scholar from University of South Carolina, on that, who's been doing great work in that space, a guy named Derek Black, who has a book called Schoolhouse Burning.
Derek Black is his name?
And he's an outstanding scholar of that kind of that Reconstruction era state constitutionalism around the provision of public schooling. And yet there's so many interesting stories about how these state requirements to educate all children came about. But, as it stands, the current language in Florida is that much more recent. These are things that you yourself got to vote on. I didn't live here. Had I lived here, I would have been voting on that too. I'm old enough to have voted the Florida constitutional provisions.
Yeah. It was a very ambitious amendment. I remember reading it and it was like, well, who could be against this? And it did pass decisively. But again, just from the fiscal standpoint, I thought, how is this going to be funded? And the messaging at the time was, we're funding this through the lottery proceeds. That's why we can have a lottery, because we're just going to have the best public education system in the country. I was excited about it and thought, great, because one of the concerns I had in moving here was that nationally, Florida was not, I came from the Northeast. I went to college at UVA, another school with strong public education, another state. And I was just like, okay, this is going to be exciting. And it just never panned out, I never saw the commitment. And what's really disturbing is when you're seeing your own state Supreme Court say it's not possible, or come up with verbiage that says you just gives the legislature an out. So we've got that situation, but now you've got these systems, charter schools, schools of hope. Tell us, Bruce, what the impact, because we're in the very early stages of universal vouchers and we're seeing such a hit. Is it $3.8 billion of state money? Talk to us about that.
Right. I mean, that's what was budgeted. And of course, the budget has been, as I understand, it's been blown to get well over $4 billion, right? So it's actually about, the amount of money that comes from the state to go to public schools, that piece of it makes up about 25%. And about 70% of that is going to kids who were already enrolled in private schools. So, I mean, from the legislative standpoint, we should think of this as the legislature has decided to expand the provision of publicly financed education to include a large number of kids who were already in private schools to begin with. Mm-hmm. They should be, you know, at the most basic level, there should be a kind of a cost-benefit analysis on that. That 70% of the now over $4 billion, I did it at 70% of the 3.8 budgeted in my report, would be enough money to drive almost $5,000 per pupil into the poorest 20% of schools, public district schools in the state. And we know from a large body of research, which I also talk about in my report, that the greater return on investment to schooling is when money is driven into higher poverty settings or schools or districts that previously had lower spending. The greater bang for the buck would be for that money to be directed into the state aid to K-12 public schools, not redirected to serve kids who were already enrolled in private schools on average from higher income families. The interesting mm-hmm. twist is that the body of research out there on the kids who do switch from public district schools to private schools on a voucher program suggests that they actually suffer substantial damages in their outcomes. So we're spending money to lower outcomes for the kids who switch, and we're spending money on kids who don't need it for the kids who are already there, when it could have instead gone to the public districts. And it's not a trivial, we're talking about almost $5,000 per pupil to the poorest 20%, $2,000 per pupil to the next 20% just off of that money, which coincidentally is roughly what what the Schools of Hope legislation is trying to drive into this select subset of charter schools, an additional $4,000 plus free facilities. That's needed. I'm going all
I know
around.
There's so much to talk about in what you just said. So, you know, one of my concerns ever since I've been doing this show now, it's been over 10 years, that the charter school lobby and charter school interests this is a way for private interests to get their hands on public money. One of the biggest, I go back to where my sister teaches in the state of Connecticut, the second largest lobbying group in the state of Connecticut. This was a few years ago. I don't know if it's still true, but it was hedge funds lobbying for charter schools.
It's still true.
Yeah, okay. Well, I want to unpack this. My listeners, I might sound like a broken record, but these simple things, people need to understand the dynamics behind the charter schools. So they set up separate companies that own the real estate, and then the real estate is leased to the charter school. And this may account partly for the lousy outcomes, relatively speaking, at charter schools. Their budgets are going to pay real estate leases. Like up to 40% of some of their budgets go to pay just rent on the building. And the hedge funds are investing in real estate investment trusts that are benefiting from these bundled leases. Wall Street wants a guaranteed rate of return. The best payer you can have is the government. Government paying for leases for charter schools is fluffing up the profits of hedge funds. At whose expense? At the expense of children who need an education. And you want to talk about to race to the bottom in this country, the fact that we have let profiteers get into public school budgets like this, we are going to be reaping what we sow over the next generations in lousy education outcomes. Who's running for governor? Byron Donalds, whose wife is a charter school owner. I mean, so we need to wake up Florida, I think. and look at the dynamics, the economic dynamics behind who wants to be in charge and now how they're profiting from pillaging the public sector.
Right. And there's so many, this is something for the last 10 years I've actually written a lot about. It was not something I wanted to be, right? I got dragged into writing a piece on the business of charter schools, which I wrote. It's now a 10-year-old piece, and it's the piece that I've probably had to talk to more reporters around the country about than anything else I've written. Because much of it deals with the structure of the real estate dealings of charter school operators. And there's some big public kind of policy issues there too, that, you know, what happens if we're in a space where we've got more and more kids going into charter schools, and we're setting up a system where basically, you know, we're sending, say, $10,000 per pupil for each kid who goes to the charter school, and the charter school management company, which is the left hand, is taking that $10,000, and they've got a right hand, which is a real estate acquisition company.
Yeah.
Which is going to take on debt through revenue bonds and guarantee that with $2,000 per pupil or up to $4,000 of the 10 from the left hand.
They're guaranteeing it with our property taxes.
They're guaranteeing it with taxpayer money to buy assets for private ownership and benefit. And sometimes it's worse than that, because sometimes they are actually buying below market value what was a public school district building. So think through how this works, right? The public through municipal bonds and other tax sources pay public dollars to buy, build, and maintain this building. And now it's being sold under market value. The public is going to pay for it a second time. The public will have paid for it twice, and now someone else owns it.
You know, I don't know if it's a totally apt analogy, but it reminds me of, you know, selling a car for parts. And somebody, you know, the car or the school system is to function, you know, for a car to get you someplace, for the school system to optimize the potential, the human potential of all kids. And it is in everybody's interest that all kids, poor kids are not stupid kids. They're just born into families that don't have the same resources. And we know that they are smart. I mean, my dad was a poor kid. My mom was a poor kid, you know. And when you educate people, regardless of their economic circumstances, the whole society benefits because they become what they truly can be, whether it's an AC maintenance person, whether it's a physics professor like my dad, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's somebody who's building homes, whether it's somebody who's cleaning houses. We need people to be educated. So to watch the government and the players in the government participate, first of all, in selling us a system that actually doesn't produce good outcomes. So, you know, the charter schools are not doing any better when it comes to test scores. I love the fact that your report points this out. I want to share that. We're on Zoom, so, you know, I know most people are listening, but we'll talk about that. But in the end, the only people this really works for economically are the owners of charter schools. Because at the end of the day, the kids aren't benefiting and our society as a whole suffers because our kids aren't getting the education that they could get if we just hunkered down and, you know, were efficient with our resources and committed to public schools. Real public schools.
Right. A couple additional points on that, and this is something I brought up in other places where I saw that you know, in some cases, Newark, New Jersey, some of the Ohio mid-sized cities, and elsewhere, if we decided that chartering was a bad idea and/or they weren't benefiting kids and wanted to change our minds, the problem is that 40% of the capital stock has been sold off. So it's hard to go back.
To pull it back. Unless you do an eminent domain.
Right.
I'm sorry. You know, I don't see why it shouldn't be eminent domain.
It's actually one of the reasons why I'm not totally opposed to setting up a good centralized space allocation system that does let charters use an appropriate financial arrangement space that continues to be owned by the public rather than selling it to them undervalued price and having them own it. It's better than that. I'm looking for the less bad option in that case.
Yeah. Bruce, can I just want to share this to get to the data that you put in your report about test scores. And, you know, I'm really talking about corporate charter schools. And I want to, everyone, this is a live show, WSLR. I'm here with Bruce Baker, who's a professor at the University of Miami, who moved to Florida in part to research what's going on, a boots on the ground look at what's going on with Florida public schools in the environment of universal vouchers, schools of hope, corporate charter schools. So, Bruce, in this study that you share in your report, you document that charter schools are not producing better testing outcomes. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, on average, given one of the things I start out by showing is that charter schools are on average set up in lower income neighborhoods, but they're serving a smaller share of low income kids than districts, even though they're in the lower income neighborhoods, and a much smaller share of children with disabilities, and especially more severe disabilities, and a much smaller share of English learners.
They're actually have a disproportionate number of easier kids to educate.
Right.
That's fair.
So when we compare them against otherwise similar schools, on average, at least, and this was a first quick cut on the data, but I've run this three different ways now just to make sure that what I'm looking at is what I'm looking at, that on average, the charter schools have lower performance than district regular schools by about a quarter of a standard deviation on kind of reading and math, all grades standardized. And I did it by, you know, percent proficient or higher, percent in the highest two categories, and I took the scale scores, and I did it by the scale score. They got an even bigger difference. That charters, on average, aren't doing as well as regular district schools, and district magnet schools are, on average, doing better than regular district schools. But the bigger story is that the charter performance, you know, we're looking at, you know, 15% of kids statewide, you know, 20% in Miami-Dade. The performance is all over the place, and they are still, on average, underserving higher-need student populations.
So they have the easier kids to educate, and they're doing worse.
Compared to schools serving simple kids. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. And one of the takes that I got, part of the Schools of Hope legislation talks about, well, we got to give substantially more money to these special charter operators, which really, to me, I have one line in my more recent blog post. It says this purported need to create a special class of charters that do offer hope, requiring access to free capital and substantial additional funding in order to be successful, is indicative of the systemic problem state legislators have failed to address, right? If these guys need more money to succeed with high need populations, well, maybe that's because schools need more money.
Period. Yeah.
It strikes me that the requirement for a uniform system of public schooling would suggest that that itself might be unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Getting declared as such a story. I suggested in my more recent kind of policy summary, pause this charter system, vet the charter operators that presently exist, and figure out how to sift and sort through. I see there being two cats. There are charter operators who are well-meaning and trying to run a new school who happen to also have similar real estate dealings. And then there are those that are real estate shell companies that happen in the charter system, a separate group of them. Florida's level of funding for schools generally, including charter schools, is so low that leading charter operators from other parts of the country, from New York, New Jersey, Boston, aren't interested. They're interested in being able to say, we're successful, look how good we are, when they try to evaluate their options for doing what they want to do in Florida they realize they can't.
Yeah, because Florida funding is so low.
Can't do it, so which is also why I believe that, you know, Success Academy is in part behind the push to say we need at least $5,000 more per pupil and a free building.
So Success Academies is a New York based firm that has claimed to be producing better outcomes in the state of New York and New York City. Your report shows that that actually should be questioned because, again, they have proportionally more children that are easier to educate. That's my shorthand.
Huge margin of difference. Exactly.
Yeah, because one of the things that I learned from Diane Ravitch, who's done so much work on public education, is that the biggest predictor of student success is the family's income. That family income, the economic status of the family, and, you know, is tied to so many things, but that's the biggest predictor of academic success. So when you've got charter schools cherry picking kids who are easier to educate because they come from families that are reading to them at night and have higher incomes, you know, dad is a computer specialist and mom, you know, those kids get different experiences at home. They're the easier to educate kids. Charter schools are cherry picking those kids. And so New York Success Academies are no different. They come to Florida, and as you write in your report, they want more money, right?
I want to first kind of touch on that cherry picking idea. There are a number of mechanisms by which a charter school ends up educating a lower need, you know, fewer children from legitimately low income backgrounds, fewer English learners, and fewer kids with disabilities. The primary mechanism of no excuses charter schools in the Northeast is a push out and a holdback method where, you know, kids simply can't, you know, progress forward unless they hit these benchmarks and they get frustrated and they leave, or they can't, or they don't follow the rigid disciplinary practices and policies, or their parents can't show up to the obligatory political rallies and stuff like that. And those kids get pushed out. 40%, 60% of black boys in some of the New York and New Jersey, no excuses, charter schools don't make it from 9th to 12th grade. Some similarities in the Connecticut charter schools that I looked at in the past. So that's how, by the time they graduate, you end up with a population that is substantially different. Yeah, a very high female-to-male ratio, a very low percent of kids. They aren't English learners, and children with disabilities aren't going to the no-excuses schools to begin with. But one of the things I say about, I do think generally Success Academies is probably a better run charter chain than most of what we have in Florida, but I don't think they offer a track record that says that they have a track record of success with the kind of kids they'd be required to serve in Miami-Dade. They serve very few to any English learners in their New York City context. They serve a relatively large black student population that are among the upper income, among the lower income students, and they have high attrition rates because of their rigid structures that are in part used to impose those attrition rates. Probably a better school than much of what we have here, but not a track record of serving the kind of kids. So we ought to look for schools that do have a track record of serving the kind of kids that they need to serve here, not what they're serving in Manhattan.
Yeah. And don't, you know, as I listen to this, because people's The way people have certain ideas about what looks like a good school, you know, it seems to me that, and you had said something earlier that children who go from a public school to a charter school, often their educational, on average, their educational performance goes down.
With voucher receiving private school, we have that evidence, yes.
Okay. So, all right, so the universal voucher program, we're seeing that when kids make that switch, their performance goes down. To what extent, and your report doesn't get into this, but I'm curious, I think that parents, these schools put on a very good face, and they, you know, when you put a kid in a uniform and everybody's wearing a uniform and the school building is new, I just think there's an inherent feeling that, oh, this is a good school. Like, there's just some outer bias that my kid's getting a good education. So that it seems to me that that outer picture is masking a reality that's not delivering.
Well, so there are some, I mean, it's there's so many kind of weird conflicting messages that come through, because I think the things that parents respond to are things like, a nicer building, definitely, something you respond to. Sort of cleaner, safer spaces. Access, parental access to open communication with the adults who interact with their kid. Mm-hmm. Seeing kid is in smaller classes, right? And parents, I think, will place higher preference over smaller classes, direct access to the adults who interact with their kids, and those nice spaces over the test scores, right? Mm-hmm. I think some of those things probably do matter as much, if not more, than the test scores in a lot of ways. But those are also the things that come from providing adequate resources to mm-hmm. public. It's also why those 2002 amendments that had the class size piece.
Right.
So by such a decent margin, right? So
yeah.
We were putting the money into public district infrastructure, keeping class sizes small, making sure there was enough money to provide the support staff necessary. That contrast that parents are looking for, oh, I can talk to the principal or my kid's teacher. There are only 12 to 14 other kids in there without even thinking about whether or not the teacher happens to possess any relevant qualifications.
Yeah, right.
That kind of stuff substantively matters, and it could be provided across the public system for everyone uniformly, efficiently, equitably.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how we need to reform these systems. So let's get into that. What are your recommendations for Florida? I mean, how should we be moving forward, given we've got all these different systems? We've got high-income families who are now being subsidized, private school tuitions that are likely going up because they're now being subsidized. You're putting billions of dollars toward right. a sector of kids that didn't need the help, period.
And the schools, as you said, tuition increases because they're getting the subsidy.
Because, you know, Reagan, you say what you subsidize, you get more of, and that's actually being flipped now to help. Well, it's being done to assist higher income families. We've got these schools of hope going into underutilized public school buildings and taking over. And I say that in quotes, underutilized. I'm not sure the criteria makes sense. We've got universal vouchers, corporate charter schools. How does the public actually take this situation? How does a responsible legislature get in there and bring some accountability for outcomes?
I had laid out my kind of policy wonky recommendations of let's start that process of figuring out what. The state has already kind of implicitly acknowledged, well, to really be successful, you probably need at least like 50% more funding. But we're only going to give it to these schools over here rather than make this. And I think we need to, my recommendation number one on my most recent blog post was, you know, financing a uniform system of high quality public schools. Do the hard work that the court wasn't willing to mandate in 2019 of identifying those standards and determining the costs of them. I mean, that's something I'm working with teams around the country to estimate that for any number of states. The next recommendations around those choice programs are let's stop and pause. Let's just repeal the schools of hope thing do a deep evaluation of the accountability metrics used for existing charter schools, which aren't doing so well. focused on both who they serve and what they achieve with them. So really vet the existing charter schools and bring down the hammer where it needs to be brought down. And stop. And if we think we need to look for better, better charter operators from elsewhere to come in, then let's vet those who actually have relevant track records for serving the kind of kids they'd serve in Florida. And within that charter system, figure out an equitable way based on the students served to distribute the funding and manage capital space for charter operators. The constitutional authority for managing that capital space lies with local boards of education. So from a local action, parents rising up, citizen taxpayers rising up perspective, I would be concerned by your local board of education simply relinquishing that authority because a regulatory structure said they have to when the authority that they have over those facilities rests in the Constitution. So get angry if your local board members are willing to simply let their authority be usurped by the schools, because this is land and buildings you paid for and continue to pay to maintain. Schools will actually, in an imbalanced way, require you to continue to pay to maintain those. The local board, if anything, local boards could be asked to submit plans for figuring out just like a 5-year facility plan for your regular district schools. Within it do we accommodate charter schools? The voucher thing is the least efficient of all the things that we're doing. We're subsidizing, kids from families that don't need it. Most of the kids in the system, 70% or so are that. And about 50% of that money is probably going to tuition increase. And then kids who do, so I suggest kind of freeze, best case, no new cohorts added. Down, use that money to bring back into the high poverty public district schools. Don't buy some subset of schools to be non-uniformly treated for success, because that's in direct opposition to the constitutional language. And it's the legislature's obligation to do these things, whether the court forces them to or not. Simply because the court didn't say you have to do this doesn't mean it's not what they should be doing.
It's really up to the public through understanding, good information like what you're doing, what you've put out there, to hold these officials accountable for all the promises they've made about some kind of alleluia system that's going to change everything since the early 2000s. We've had enough time to watch them to know that there's no there. They're not doing it. These ideas that they have are not panning out. I'd like to see a requirement that if you get public money in the state of Florida, you are subject to the same standards that public schools are subject to. If you actually impose the same standards, and it's just about if you're getting public money, these are the benchmarks that you must abide by. These are the regulations. You're no different than the public school. I think we would weed out a lot of the weak, non-performing schools.
And there should be the same level of detail in the financial reporting. And there should be the same types of kind of checks and balances, procedures on the awarding of contracts for contractual services, for payroll, for transportation, whatever, that there should be competitive bidding requirements.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Hire your uncles, cousins, aunts to run your payroll or to provide your curriculum materials. These things, Matt, I would go so far as to say, to the extent that public money is being used to purchase anything of, any material, supplies, equipment, whatever, that anything that is purchased with public money remains owned by the public.
Yes.
That was an issue in the state of Ohio years ago when the management company White Hat was doing all the contracting to buy desks, chairs, computers, and stuff like that. And conceivably, the board that governs a charter school should be able to fire the management company and hire a new one. The problem is the boards of these schools run that had hired White Hat found they couldn't fire White Hat because White Hat said, but we own all your stuff. And though they purchased it with public dollars.
So this is where we have
Connecticut management company.
Yeah. So just for people to really think about that, this is corporate welfare. This is, you know, you always hear from a certain wing in our political world, you've got to run government like a business. You've got to run it like a business. Well, if you ran it like a business, you would keep the assets. Okay. You wouldn't give them away. You know, you're not supposed to be funding something for the profit of shareholders or the stakeholders of the public should be owning the things that we're funding. And it is absolute, like, Florida's approach to education has become crazy, and it is not doing right by our kids when you look at the outcomes. Bruce, tell me about Billy Townsend's done some incredible work documenting what he calls Florida's education regression, that what happens with Florida students from third grade, if you look at the test scores in Florida schools in third grade or fourth grade, and then you look at what's going on in 10th grade, our state is the worst in the country for educational decline between fourth and 10th grade. And Townsend, who served on the Polk County School Board, and he's been an incredibly smart critic of Florida education in my book, and he's saying all of this running around that happens with these kids doing vouchers, going in and out of schools, contributes to this massive educational decline that Florida, in the race to the bottom, we're seeing it happening between fourth and 10th grade. Have you looked at that and what's going on with this decline?
I have looked at it between fourth and eighth grade. And yeah, the same decline is there. And they're really interesting. I mean, there's so many narratives that come out of this. And I am trying to unpack what are the most kind of statistically valid narratives. But yes, Florida does it has a greater decline from fourth to eighth grade. The other thing that's really interesting is, as much as people talked about this kind of how Florida was so great during COVID by keeping schools open, first of all, what people have learned, I mean, we could already see it in the data, I don't know why people crafted that false narrative, was that achievement was declining in the two national assessment cycles before COVID started and declined at a similar rate during COVID. That's the case in Florida, and in fact, a pretty steep decline through that whole period. The issue with Florida is that while other states started to level off or rebound after COVID, Florida from 22 to 24 on those national assessments continued to decline rapidly at eighth grade. The other thing that's important in the research you cited and why I refer to the eighth grade numbers a lot rather than fourth grade is that period from fourth to eighth or fourth to 10th grade is what shows the cumulative effects of being in this system over time.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. we boosted our fourth grade scores with retention policies and stuff like that. You don't get to move forward to that grade and take the test of that grade until you do well enough on the test in the earlier grade. So you get that boost, but then even though we've gotten that boost, we're seeing a sharper drop from there forward. And that is the drop associated with the cumulative effects of being in the system, a system where we've continued depriving that system of resources over time. And there's some great studies that show just nationally, there was the Great Recession from 2008 to 2011 really hit public school funding hard and inequitably. And in the states that were already determined to drive their systems into the ground, they took it as an opportunity to continue. So as the economy rebounded elsewhere, certain states like Arizona, Florida, Tennessee, Colorado, a number of them just kept driving their system into the ground. There's research showing that had detrimental effects on outcomes that I talk about in my school funding and outcomes. It's a Kirbo Jackson, it's a Jackson and Wigger piece that talks about the recessionary effects on student outcomes. And the other piece that's interesting is there's been all this banter about some southern state, red state miracle, usually pointing to Mississippi as having these great gains in early grades reading scores. Their gains don't carry over to eighth grade either, but and somehow holding it up as a model. You know what Mississippi doesn't have? Mississippi has only a tiny share of kids in charters and has no universal vouchers. So you want to hold it up as, oh, these southern states are of, you know, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, look at Mississippi, look at its reading gains. Well, then stay consistent and realize that Mississippi has like maybe 1% of kids, not 15 or 20 in charters, and vouchers only for kids in specific categories of disability, no universal vouchers. So maybe that's what works.
You know, maybe that's what works.
You're at the leap, but,
I gotta say, I'm so, you know, I came across some of your work while I was reading on Substack. I am so thrilled that we have somebody like you doing this work in Florida, because where there's crisis, there's opportunity, right? I mean, we have an opportunity to really look at the 20-year mess that this legislature has delivered to us. Understand that the ones who are really paying the price are Florida's children, and we have to turn this around. And we've got somebody running for governor whose spouse is fully invested in the status quo, and that needs to be something that we all have a look at. So on that note, I want to invite you back, because there's...
I'd love to come back.
Yeah, there's so much more for you to share about your great research. We all have an interest in making sure our kids do well. And it's people like you that shine the light on what's really going on that makes such a difference. So I salute your work, and I thank you that you're dedicating your life, your work to this effort. It's terrific. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me and spending this much time talking about this stuff.
Yeah, well, that's why the show's called The Detail, right? We want to get into...
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, we want to get into understanding what's really going on. So everybody, you have been listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. I want to invite you this afternoon. This is Thursday, January 15th at 4 p.m., WSLR 96.5 presents the kickoff of our Democracy and Civic Engagement webinar series produced in partnership with First Responders for Democracy. Today's webinar features Jeffrey Orenstein, Ph.D., speaking on democracy in crisis. He'll explore the forces putting pressure on democratic institutions, the warning signs we're seeing right now, and what engaged citizens can do to respond. The webinar is free, open to the public, takes place online at 4 p.m. this afternoon. I will be a featured speaker in the series on February 19th discussing the role of money in politics, and I hope you can join us then as well. To register, join the Democracy and Civic Engagement webinar. Click on the main banner at WSLR.org. Bruce, where can people learn more about your work? You're on Substack, is that right?
I am, you know, I'm a relic of the past. I've got a WordPress site, but it's at schoolfinance101.com.
Okay. Schoolfinance101.com. Okay.
There's the blog. There are policy reports and a number of other resources, where you can find my work, including the Florida report, a slide deck on Florida schools, and eventually, links to any of these video conversations that we've had. We've had a few down here so far.
Awesome. Everybody, thanks so much for listening. Be sure to stay tuned for more public affairs programming here on WSLR. Make it a great day.
That's pretty inventive kind of stuff to me, you know? And the way he used a wang bar was completely different than anybody had heard do it. his touch, you know, the soft, clear. And as well as all that, I believe that he took tones a lot further than anyone had taken them. You know, he would take harmonics and find, if he couldn't get it out of a straight guitar, he would find an effect. I think he opened up all those doors.